Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Healthcare. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 280. Zena, bring us up to date on that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 280 changes the Board of Medical Imaging 12-member composition. It specifies one member must be a radiologist and specifies three other members, and there is a -5 amendment. There is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Okay, Ed Connolly, please come forward and we will explain the -5 amendments. And evidently, OMA's on board, you're on board, there should be no issues with it, right?
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, my name is Ed Connolly. I'm the executive director of the Board of Medical Imaging. I think that's correct. We were before the committee a couple weeks ago with the public hearing and came up with decided to get together with the medical association and work out an amendment that was more comfortable for them, so we have something that we can both work with. The bill as drafted says that the board can take currently under current law there's four physician members of the board. We've only been able to fill one of those positions most times. The bill says that we could take those three empty positions and just fill them with any of the above. Could be physician members, licensee members, or members of the public. The amendment says that the -5 amendment says that we'll attempt to fill those slots with physician members first. So there'll be if applicants or if qualified applicants are available, those slots will go to physicians. One will always be a radiologist member. That doesn't change. But those three open slots now will have to first be filled by physicians. And if there are no physicians available, then they could be filled with any of the above. That's the first part of the -5 amendment. The second part of the -5 amendment addresses a different issue that we had brought up after this bill was first introduced. We had had a loss. We were in a legal action with a licensee whose license we were attempting to revoke. The attorney for the licensee started looking at our board membership and saying, well, these licensees aren't practicing, and started picking at the board membership and challenging the legitimacy of the board, and then was in the direction of saying that our board wasn't legitimate when it made the decision against the licensee. So because a couple of our licensees were supervisors, and they weren't, you could say maybe they weren't practicing. Anyway, that's where it was headed. And so what this does, it says instead of practicing, it says that the licensees must be actively engaged. And actively engaged is defined as directly practicing medical imaging, supervising or administering a medical imaging program at a medical institution, teaching at or administering a medical imaging program at an educational institution, or retired from active practice for up to 5 years.
Great. Is there any discussion on that, on the -5 amendments? Do I have a motion?
I've got it. That's okay, Senator.
Go.
Okay, Madam Chair, I move to adopt the -5 amendments dated 2/12/2015.
Senator Steiner Hayward moves to adopt the -5 amendments dated 2/12/15. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 280 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Steiner Hayward moves Senate Bill 280 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Knope.
Aye.
Senator Shields.
Aye.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
Chair Monis Anderson.
Aye. Motion carries. And is there anyone have a dire need to carry this bill?
I think Steiner Hayward made the motion.
Okay.
No,
Steiner Hayward will carry the bill. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 280, and we're going to have a brief 10-minute informational on diabetes. So I'm opening an informational meeting on diabetes.
You've supported other bills.
Is it Christine? Yes. Scott and Arnie.
Non-controversial.
Okay.
Good afternoon, committee.
Kirsten. Thank you. Great. All right. Excellent. Technology. Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. I'm Kirsten Aird. I'm the Chronic Disease Programs Manager at the Public Health Division with the Oregon Health Authority, and I'm here today to talk with you about diabetes. Diabetes is a problem. The number of people with diabetes is increasing, and it is costly. To address this problem, Oregon developed a strategic plan to slow the rate of diabetes in 2009. And as required by Senate Bill 169 last session, the 2013 session, the Public Health Division prepared a report including the burden of diabetes and progress on the 2009 strategic plan. And that is available on the Public Health Division's website. Diabetes has more than doubled since 1990 in the last 25 years. Today, there are over 287,000 adults living with diabetes, and over 7,000 additional diagnoses each year are made. It's important to note that over 1 million people have prediabetes. The data is clear. In order to address diabetes in Oregon, we must also address obesity. Similar to diabetes, adult obesity in Oregon has increased over the last 25 years. Since 1990, we've seen a 121% increase in prevalence. People who are obese are at a much higher risk at developing diabetes compared to those who are at a healthy weight. And over half of the adults in Oregon who have diabetes are obese. Obesity is largely caused by poor nutrition and lack of physical activity. Today, 27% of Oregon adults are obese, and 70% are overweight or obese. And about 10% of our 11th graders are obese. While about 9% of our adult population has obesity, there are some communities that are much more disproportionately affected than others. About 12% of those with less than a high school graduation rate have diabetes, compared to 5% with those with college degrees. 19% of the adult Oregon Health Plan members have diabetes, compared to only 7% of adults on employer-provided insurance. And among racial and ethnic minority groups, nearly one quarter of African Americans, 15% of Latinos, and 14% of American Indians or Alaska Natives have diabetes, compared to just 7% in the non-Hispanic white population. This makes it very expensive, all of this together. According to the ADA, $2.2 billion in excess medical expenditures are spent each year in Oregon, averaging $7,800 per person with diabetes. Additional cost as an effect due to reduced productivity, absenteeism, etc., is close to $840 million in Oregon annually, for a total of $3 billion per year. If diabetes is not properly managed or controlled, severe complications such as infections, nerve damage, blindness, and kidney damage can result and lead in hospitalizations. In Oregon, we spend nearly $44 million on hospitalizations with an average cost of $10,000 per hospitalization. Again, in 07, the legislature asked for the development of the strategic plan to slow the rate of diabetes in Oregon. The update to that plan, some things have changed, but much has not. The same holds true today. To reverse the trends of diabetes and obesity, Oregon needs to take a comprehensive state and community-wide approach, which was identified in 2009. It still is the highest priority today to establish and fund a statewide obesity prevention and education program to support population-wide interventions to reduce obesity, diabetes, and other chronic diseases. We are all in this together, and a collaborative approach is what is needed. We have been able to leverage some opportunities as part of this plan. Over the last couple years, PEB and OEB have decided to include the National Diabetes Prevention Program and the Stanford's Chronic Disease Self-Management Programs as part of their benefits for public employees. The Educators Board has done the same thing and is working on an Eastern Oregon pilot right now to build out the National Diabetes Prevention Program. The Oregon Metrics and Scoring Committee included blood sugar as one of the main incentives CCO metrics. And OHA has been working on cross-agency collaborations with the Department of Education and the Department of Transportation to increase access to healthy foods and opportunities for physical activity and walkable communities. But again, much remains to be done. The Senate Bill 169 Diabetes Reports also contains funding recommendations to implement the strategic plan, including the establishment of a comprehensive obesity prevention and education program. Those funding recommendations can be found on page 47 of that report. Thank you very much for the opportunity to share this information with you today, and I'll take any questions the committee may have.
Thank you so much. Is there any questions?
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the committee for serving. Thank you for the good work that I know you have done, that we've worked together on with diabetes, and thank you for the good work that I know that each of you will do as a committee moving forward. My name is Scott Bruin. I'm from Westland, Oregon. I'm here with my 13-year-old daughter, Katie Bruin, also from Westland, Oregon. Today we are here to speak on behalf, to speak on behalf of the American Diabetes Association, and you see a whole bunch of people wearing red T-shirts, and you've seen them around the Capitol today and in your offices. So first of all, thank you for taking the time to meet with each of us and to hear kind of our personal stories as it relates to diabetes. I'm also here as somebody who served in the legislature and worked hard on diabetes issues, including the bill in 2007 that was referenced earlier. I'm here as somebody who's had diabetes for 33 years, but mostly and most importantly, I'm here as the father of a 13-year-old who was diagnosed with diabetes 2.5 years ago, and that's Katie. Madam Chair, if you would allow me, I'd like to give just a quick little layman's primer on diabetes because I think it's important to kind of the discussion we're having. Years ago, decades ago, and I know most, if not all of you know this, there were basically two kinds of diabetes, not too originally. One was called type 1 and one was called type 2. Type 1, the kind that Katie and I have, is otherwise known as juvenile onset. And traditionally, back in yesteryear, people would get that when they were kids. They would get it when they're 5, 6, 10 years old. I got mine when I was 15. But basically, by the time people were out of their teens or certainly their 20s, you didn't hear much about type 1 diabetes anymore. Type 2 traditionally has been one that adults get. It's usually hits sometime in middle age or later. Usually has to do with being overweight. Generally, that was the trend in the past. Over the last couple decades, you've seen a kind of a morphing. You've seen type 1 diabetes, again, juvenile onset, shift forward, if you will. So you now see more and more people diagnosed in their 20s and their 30s, and even later related to type 1 diabetes. And of course, I shouldn't say of course, but probably this has some environmental factor that attributes to that. At the same time, you've seen type 2, which again used to be middle-aged adult onset diabetes. You've seen that get younger. You've seen kids get diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. And even when they're not diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, you see them being kind of pre-diagnosed with pre-diabetes. And so this is the changing world of diabetes in the last couple decades, which is just another way of saying this issue and this disease has become more complex, more complicated, and frankly more important that we deal with in an effective way. We heard some of the stats earlier. In Oregon, there's almost 300,000 people with diabetes and another 1.1 million people with prediabetes. It's a big part of the Oregon population. Just to put it in perspective, there's about 25 million people nationwide with diabetes. As you heard, the public cost to diabetes is staggering. Over $3 billion a year in Oregon for both the cost of medical care as well as the cost of lost productivity. That cost nationally is well over $300 billion, and that doesn't even include the chronic disease, the heart disease, the eye disease, and all the things that are related to diabetes. It is absolutely staggering. Just to put it in perspective, in the last 5 years in both Oregon and nationally, the cost to care and manage diabetes has increased by more than 40%. I've always felt, and when I was in the House side, I've always felt that there's no way that a member of the legislature, somebody serving public office, can truly do their duty their fiduciary responsibility to taxpayers without getting their arms around the explosive and runaway cost of diabetes. And so I think that's something, as we talk about the human cost of diabetes, as we talk about the health implications and just the things we want to do to make life better for people, that's important. That's most important. But also remember, putting all that aside, if we're doing our job to manage taxes for Oregonians, we have to manage the cost of diabetes because so much is related to it. And that's why we're here today. As was mentioned, in 2007, we passed a bill that I co-sponsored that was a bill that mandated mandated us to slow the growth of diabetes in Oregon and to outline a program to do that. A lot of work has been done, a lot of excellent work has been done on that front, and we've seen some positive developments. But again, with the changing nature and the changing scope of diabetes, we're just constantly reminded that there is a lot of work to be done. So today, diabetes advocates and the American Diabetes Association are respectfully here to request that the legislature do the following. And you'll hear this from me, you'll hear this as the session goes on. First of all, we ask you to implement the strategic plan as it's been outlined. We need funding for obesity prevention. We need funding for diabetes education. We need funding for school fitness programs. And we need funding for programs for healthy foods, including the Farm Direct Nutrition Program. We also ask that you help ensure that state-provided medical services like Medicaid, the Children's Health Plan, provide adequate coverage for the basics that have to do with diabetes: insulin, pumps, test strips. I know you've all heard the horror stories about people diagnosed with diabetes, but their insurance says, oh, you can only have one or two test strips a day to test blood sugars. Ladies and gentlemen, I think you know this, but I'll just say it again. There's no way on God's green earth that you can manage your diabetes, whether it's type 1 or type 2, by doing 1 to 2 blood checks a day. It just doesn't work that way. And then finally, we ask that you, and I think just coincidentally, I think you're going to be hearing this today, but we ask that you fund the task force for the school nurse program, which is Senate Bill 339 on your side and House Bill 2185 on the other side. It's really important for students like my daughter with diabetes to make sure there's adequate nurses in the schools, and certainly, and maybe we can't have nurses in every school, but to make sure that we have adequate health training and diabetes training in every school. And there's actually a program for that called Safe for Schools that the American Diabetes Association manages, and they work with school nurses, they work with teachers, they work with counselors in schools to make sure that every modern public school and private school is well-versed on the modern developments in how you manage diabetes. So it's been a wonderful program. So that was a lot of words in a short period of time. I appreciate your willingness to listen, and thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Questions? Yes. Thank you.
Good. Okay.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Senator Roebling, you wanted to say a few words?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and committee. I'm here because Senator Cruz had, for the record, Arnie Roebling, District 5. Senator Cruz keeps inviting me to this committee. Haven't been here often. And Senator and Representative, former Representative Bruin, talked to me a few months ago about restarting the caucus for the Diabetes Caucus. So that would include bicameral, bipartisan group of legislators that take this on as a really big issue, to not only in the building, but also to highlight the importance of diabetes. And I come to you because as a high school principal, and before that as a dean of students, I had the opportunity when our school nurse was sick to be the person that took care of those other kinds of problems, the health problems that took care in our school. And one of the ones that came upon us the most were type 1 diabetic kids who, for whatever reason, chose to be adolescents and therefore not take care of themselves with respect to diabetes, and they would be having very difficult problems at the school. And I got to know a little bit more about diabetes. My mother had warned me that I would have diabetes because her family always had type 2 diabetes when they got older, which was kind of a weird thing. And when I developed type 2 diabetes at about the same time as I came to the legislature, no relationship, I'm sure, it became apparent to me, and I got to go through all of the typical things that you do as a diabetic, I think, and that is denial at the beginning. So I went out and ate the wrong things on purpose just to see if it was really going to be there, and sure enough, my blood sugars went up. Then it was kind of like, yeah, but I don't really have to manage this too well. And so as I moved through the regime of different drugs, including insulin, it became apparent to me that this was not working, and my wife, in her wisdom, decided that we need to get under control again. And so I started dieting and losing a little weight, and lo and behold, I got off all of those other drugs and I took care of myself. I've been having conversations with my local CCO about having nutritionists and other people talk to the people who are on the health plan to try to manage their disease themselves rather than having it managed by physicians. No disrespect to Senator Hayward. We really need to take control of our own lives. And one of the things that came to me when Scott called me and talked to me about becoming engaged in having a caucus again was the recognition that we really do need to, as people, take responsibility for ourselves and our diseases, especially those like diabetes that cost so much. With $3 billion extra dollars, if we actually get to take all of that money and put it into the legislature, I could solve my education problems with respect to funding. In fact, if you took that $3 billion and looked at it throughout the whole legislative agenda that we're dealing with our issues with respect to the budget, we could solve most of those issues with regard to how we go about funding our healthcare system, a whole lot of other things with an additional $3 billion. Now, we know that's not state money. That's people spending it and going in other directions. But to make the point, this is an amazing amount of money, and it's an amazing problem. I just had a good friend who's diabetic who had worked here in the building before and is now works in my district lose a foot. I have watched the ravages of this disease. We don't even know, and we were talking about that earlier, when you see a death notice in the newspaper, a lot of times it's they say heart attack, this problem or that problem, when in fact it was really diabetes that had caused that death. So I think we don't let the general public know enough about what we can do to prevent it and what we can do. With my diet, my last A1C was under 6, so I'm back to pretty much normal blood sugars. The issue with respect to the materials, I check my blood at particular times, especially when I'm slipping back into the denial phase, 3 or 4 times a day just to see exactly what these different foods do to my blood sugar, because it's pretty amazing how quickly you can go up and down if you're not taking care of that kind of stuff. That's how you get to know better what you should be eating and how you should eat it and when you should eat it. There's so many different things that affect how individual people adjust to their intake of calories. So this is the first time we've made an announcement that we're going to restart the Diabetes Caucus, and I hope to engage people to get involved with it. It is an indiscriminate disease with respect to all courses of our society. However, it is much more, as you heard in the early testimony, affects the poor and ethnic groups. And we need to take that seriously with respect to equity across the lens of our country and things that we work on. And so I would encourage people to get engaged, get involved, and I'll be getting announcement out to people who would be interested in getting involved. You don't have to have diabetes to get there on the caucus, but we'd like you to have an interest in trying to make sure we move forward.
Yeah. Really quickly, thank you. Senator Roblin, thank you for coming and giving your personal testimony. And I guess I would just encourage you to consider calling it a prevention caucus, because the reality is that anything we do to prevent diabetes will also prevent high blood pressure and heart disease from other causes and many types of cancer. And so what we're really talking about is a healthy living life, you know, a healthy lifestyle. And it starts... it's fitting that we're doing this on a day when we're talking about school-based health centers, because it starts when children are very, very young. In fact, we know it really starts when women are pregnant. So we have to be thinking, if we're talking about preventing diabetes, more type 2 than type 1, but even probably type 1, about helping women be as healthy as possible before they become pregnant, helping women be as healthy as possible while they're pregnant, and making sure that infants and small children get the best nutrition possible. And that's going to set them up for a lifetime of good health. So I hope that the Diabetes Caucus, or whatever you guys end up calling
it. Maybe chronic disease. I mean, there's a whole lot of issues, but thank you for that.
Those are preventable diseases a lot of the time, and they're all preventable by some of the same actions. So thank you so much, and I look forward to working with you all on that.
Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Also, something to get on the agenda of the caucus as well, and I will do my best to participate, or at least have my staff there when I cannot be there. But to look at the diet of our inmates in our correctional institutions, I remember taking a look, it was a good 6 or 7 years ago when we did a tour of the infirmary, watching the men there munching on French fries while they were sick in the infirmary eating French fries, and it just seemed to be a disconnect. So it said to me that maybe if we you know, want to have those folks act healthier outside. They should work on being healthier inside as well.
It is actually really amazing. You mentioned potatoes. I love, they're my favorite vegetable. And it is
like
the
potatoes?
Worst. It is the worst one. I watch my blood sugar just so, and that along with bread and those kinds of things, which I also love. You know, so you look at this kind of stuff. That's why it's so difficult for people to manage it on their own. And I think one of the things we need to talk about is how do we have support groups and other things that can do. We heard some testimony earlier from some people that you need to know that there's other people going through the same thing you're going through and making the tough decisions that you have to make with respect to eating more, eating healthier. And it's not a thing you're 100% successful in, so you don't need to beat yourself up on the one day you're not successful. You need to have people there that praise you for the times you are successful, because the more often you're successful, the more often you'll be successful. So
maybe we can convince some legislators not to go around passing out candy to everybody.
I try to do dark chocolate.
Dark chocolate is actually,
and it has some other benefits. And as I tell people, I don't eat chocolate.
I know you don't.
But it gives me input to talk to people and maybe invite them to be on the in the caucus and. All good things, you know, kind of have different opportunities. But thank you for that.
Thank you very much. Our 10-minute went to a 22-minute informational hearing with that. Thank you, everyone. It's exciting about the caucus, and it's exciting about, you know, wanting to move forward to implement the plan and funding and nutrition. So with that, I'm going to close the informational meeting on diabetes and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 336. Zena.
Madam Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 336 appropriates $900,000 out of the general fund to the Oregon Health Authority to establish parity for school-based health centers. Declares an emergency effective on passage. There is no revenue impact, and there may be a fiscal impact, but the statement has not been issued.
So where's the sign-up sheet? Okay. And everyone, thank you for attending the hearing today. As chair, I want you to know that we want to provide a safe place for the committee members and the public to consider the bills that are before us. And if you do choose to testify, just use good judgment, confining your testimony to the measures that we are addressing here. And please refrain from personal attacks and disruptive behavior. Thank you. All right, with that, it's Marty
Hyen.
Who's the beginning? No, just a minute. I want the proponents first, so I'm not sure who's the, yeah.
Madam Chair, for the record, Doug Riggs on behalf of the School-Based Health Alliance. I think Maureen is going to start out with a quick PowerPoint to talk about what the bills specifically do, and then I'll have a few short comments as well.
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, my name is Maureen Hinman, and I represent the Oregon School-Based Health Alliance, a membership organization for school-based health centers around the state of Oregon. We believe that school-based health care keeps kids healthy, learning, and thriving, and that is why I'm testifying in favor of SB 336. We believe that SB 336 and SB 338 would facilitate a more efficient analysis to combine the two. So I have suggested some combined language here, as well as recommended some amendments. And I think that you have copies as well of the language. So is it okay if I go ahead and speak to that? Okay.
Yes, then I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 338 also. Okay.
Thank you. Currently, SB 336 is about parity of the school-based health center program. So currently, if a county has one school-based health center, they receive $120,000 for the biennium. But if there's more than one, they only receive $106,000 for the biennium. So this penalizes counties and medical sponsors that invest in multiple SBHCs and disincentivizes them to develop more. So in order to bring them all to parity, the cost would be about $952,000, which was one of the amended amounts. It had previously been $900,000. I'm suggesting amending that to $952,000 based on the current certified centers and those that will be opening by the end of this fiscal year. So Senate Bill 338 is a bill to provide funding for new planning grants at $900,000 for the biennium. So in the past, planning grants have been made from the Oregon Health Authority, and they're provided by communities so that they can engage in an extensive two-year community engagement process that includes parents, school districts, school board members, administrators, healthcare providers, businesses, and faith communities, and more. So this process it ensures that community members understand what the school-based health centers are and have input into the development of services and the center. So a need has been demonstrated as well. The Oregon Health Authority surveyed 26 counties, and of those, 20 said that they were interested in developing new centers in up to 25 locations. So the Oregon Health Authority, though, currently doesn't have any more funding for planning grants. So $900,000 for the biennium would support 10 new planning grants. So the amendment to add $97,000 is to focus on health equity and reducing disparities and ensure that school-based health centers are being put in the communities that most need them. They've always been located in high, free, and reduced lunch areas and areas of need, but they've also always been, the planning process has been initiated by the community. And we know that communities facing with the highest health disparities face barriers to government applications for grants and things like that. And so this would allow us to partner with nonprofit organizations that work with communities, particularly communities of color, to ensure that they can also engage in the planning process. So why SBHCs? SBHCs are an important part of achieving the state's health and education goals. They are a public health model, and they provide integrated primary, preventive, behavioral and mental health care, and sometimes even dental care. They are cost effective, leveraging an additional $2.40 through billing, grants, and other sources for every dollar that the state invests. They've been actively participating in different aspects of healthcare reform and working to improve their systems. They provide the kinds of services that help CCOs meet their state metrics, such as adolescent well visits and depression screenings. And they are effective access points, indeed sometimes the only access points for students that use them. They also contribute to education reform and academic success, usually at no expense to the schools other than the cost of the space itself. They've demonstrated that they reduce absenteeism, and studies of students in states with SBHCs as Medicaid providers have greater academic achievement than students in states without them. So I've provided you with more information in my written testimony, but in the interest of time, I'd like to move to a story I heard recently. So Monica Ray is a medical assistant in the Rainier School-Based Health Center, and last year, they had several students that said that they were considering suicide. So she made it a point with all of her struggling students to tell them that she cared about them. So every school-based health center does a patient satisfaction survey that's anonymous on a yearly basis. And last year, they received a survey from a student that said that they were planning to attempt suicide after school that day. And the visit to the center and Monica's caring prevented them from doing so. So that's a really powerful example of how school-based health centers, their presence in the school, the relationships that they can build with the students can really make a difference to a student's health as well as to an entire community. So thank you for your testimony, for hearing my testimony, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for record, Doug Riggs on behalf of the School-Based Health Alliance. I really appreciate you taking the time today to hear about these bills. I also want to thank you for your work in the past. As you know, we've almost doubled the number of school-based health centers in Oregon in the last few years. As Maureen mentioned, it's been a community effort led by local parents, local students, school boards, health advocates, et cetera. So it really is a collaborative process. I just want to make a couple quick points. These bills are really about efficient delivery of health care services. Evidence shows that children miss less school time if there's an SBHC in their community. Parents miss less work time if there's an SBHC in their community, and that benefits the educational reform, the healthcare reforms that we're talking about. One other point that Maureen touched on, which is this is really an effort to leverage a variety of resources towards a common goal. The state share is about $53,000 or $60,000 a year for an SBHC. That's a biannual number of $106,000 or $120,000. But that's only about a third of the total cost. And so SBHCs have been very good about moving to electronic health records, electronic billing, so we're able to leverage both Medicaid funding as well as private insurance funding. And then most school-based health centers, and I was on the Washington County School-Based Health Center Task Force, most of them go out and solicit private support, private dollars, foundation support. So we're taking a small amount of state investment and turning it into overall health for the school. So I'd be happy to answer any questions. We think that these are three bills combined into two that will help keep the expansion moving ahead. It will allow communities to get together and plan for the expansion in the next few years, and we'd very much appreciate any opportunity to answer questions. Thank you.
I do. How many counties have a school-based health center, at least one?
Currently 20 counties, and there are 68 centers across the state right now.
And the 10 new ones are, do you know where they're going to be or who have applications in?
That process hasn't been initiated because there's no funding currently.
Okay.
But we do know who, you know, which counties indicated an interest, and it's more than 10.
Centennial High School, which is in my district, just has a new school-based health center, and I happen to be talking to the superintendent of Centennial High School. And he was telling me it is so successful, and the community also is able to use the center. So the children in school use it, but then also their parents who wouldn't have access to health care. And so I was very excited to hear the success, at least, of the one that's in my district. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Comments? Yeah.
I just would say, Madam Chair, that it's very relevant to be having this conversation because, as I said earlier, the sooner we can intervene with kids and help them understand the benefits of a healthier lifestyle. And the nurses, nurse practitioners, PAs, MAs who work in SBHCs are generally seen as very trusted sources to these kids. And so when they offer thoughts or perceptions or give recommendations, they're usually well received. Often more so, frankly, than the child's regular primary care provider, because they're around every day. They're there in the school, and they're mm-hmm. able to access them independently. So I think that's great.
Senator Knopf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Doug, some of us, many of us, probably have received emails from concerned parents, and it has to do with the Oregon Adolescent Sexuality Conference, and they're concerned, I think, that maybe the information that was given out to students at that conference would somehow be given out on a daily basis at these clinics. Mm-hmm. So what can you do or what could you say to allay the fears of those parents?
I'll take a crack at that, Madam Chair, and Senator Canope, and I'll let Maureen fill in. The materials handed out at the conference were handed out at a conference that we did not sponsor, although we had both staff and students at the conference. None of our staff or students actually saw that presentation, so we can't comment on it directly. We've seen certainly the media coverage since then, and I think we generally agree that that would not be the kind of material that any of our centers would be sharing with their students. The other question that's come up is the question of contraceptives and other related topics, and that gets us back to the foundational elements of putting together a school-based health center. And in every case, the school district, the parents, and the community are responsible for putting the guidelines for school-based health centers together. In the case of many of the school-based health centers, they follow the Oregon City model, which is to focus on mental health, behavioral health, physical health, and dental health, and not to focus on family planning or contraceptives or the types of things that you're generally talking about. So I think we generally agree that the materials that we saw on the news were inappropriate for use in an SBHC and have not been presented in any way, shape, or form, as far as we know.
I was the first school-based health clinic nurse at Oregon City High School, and I know in planning for that, the school board had a lot of input in what they wanted to have in their school-based health clinic, and that's for every school-based health clinic. And we at Oregon City High School said we did not want contraceptives or options counseling in that school-based health center. So they still don't. It's up to each school board to determine what services they want in their school-based health center.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Canope, I live in Washington County. Prior to working with the network, I was on the task force to look at school-based health centers in Washington County, and I attended the board meetings in the Tiger Tualatin School District where my children attend school, and this was a discussion that came up, and there was unanimous agreement that the Oregon City model made sense. So I'm very comfortable with my two teenage daughters at Tigard High School that they are not being shown any inappropriate materials. I know other students and teachers in the district, and they feel very comfortable. When you go to a school-based health center, it's essentially a small medical clinic that provides a variety of mental health, behavioral health, physical health, and in some cases oral health assistance for children, and makes a difference in their health care.
Follow up?
Yes.
Doug, how is the parental interaction as it relates to the students who attend the health clinic, you know, that go to the clinic, the school-based clinic? So where does the parental involvement start or stop at those clinics?
Good question. Madam Chair, Senator Canope. So school-based health centers have certification standards, and they all have a requirement to have a parental engagement policy, and they make extensive efforts to involve the parents in the medical care of the students. That's a high priority for them. Just as connecting with the student's primary care provider is. So they're working hard to do care coordination in the way that works the best for the student and the family.
Can I just make a quick comment? I, as a physician, strongly encourage patients to stay connected with their parents about their health care needs. That being said, I would point out that under Oregon law, anyone over the age of 15 has a right to seek medical care for pretty much anything without parental permission and consent. They aren't allowed to participate in research projects without parental consent, but they are allowed to get medical care. And for matters of mental health, substance abuse, or sexual health issues, they're allowed to seek help without parental permission at any age under our state law. So I think it's very, very important that regardless of the condition that they're seeking care for, or what they're seeking advice for, that we always strongly encourage kids to engage their parents. We just need to bear in mind, as I'm sure the SBHCs do, that our state law says that kids do have the right at a certain point in their lives to get independent care for certain parts of their health.
And as an example, I had a couple of cases. I always wanted to involve the parents, but in a couple of cases, there was abuse in the home. And so there was a case where she wanted to seek medical care but did not want her father in particular to know about that. So there are situations where the student feels she's at more risk due to the situation at home. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
All right. Marty Han, Rebecca Roth, and John, is it Diesel? Dezel? Dezel.
Go ahead. Hi. My name is Marty Hyan, and I live here in Salem. I am a parent
I'm legally responsible for my son's actions. I am responsible to feed him, to clothe him, and to shelter him. I am responsible for my son's health care, not the state, not the Department of Education. The Department of Education, in sponsoring or at least having something to do with the sex conference at Seaside, has proven themselves unable to use common sense when teaching health to children that we entrust to them every day. Teaching children how to have sex and how to pleasure themselves is abhorrent. These are private matters and are not the business of the state or the school district. Teaching health is not teaching how to have sex. How do I know that the health centers won't promote sex or be providing birth control? Well, child visits, depression analysis, and such things should not be done without the parent's knowledge and consent beforehand. The parent is in charge of their child's medical care. The parent is legally liable for everything that child does, yet you take away part of their responsibility and put it in your own hands. And I don't think that's right. Thank you.
Thank you. And just a comment. I want you all to know that the school-based health centers are totally accountable to their school boards. So this is a local issue. And so if you do not like what services are at your school-based health center, it's really important to go to your school boards because they are the ones that make those decisions.
Can I say one more thing? Because I believe Planned Parenthood is very much involved in our local health centers here in Salem. So I will go to the local board.
Thank you. Thanks. Who's next?
Go ahead.
Okay. Yes, I'm Rebecca Roth, Salem, Oregon. And yes, Planned Parenthood is involved, and they provide curriculum that is very distasteful and is designed to promote kids becoming sexually active. This book here, Blood Money, is written by a lady who owned 5 abortion clinics. She always tried to get access to the schools. She wanted to come into the classrooms and get kids sexually active. She loved it when she could get a kindergarten class. And the first, in 10 minutes, it only took her 10 minutes to turn the kindergartners against their parents and believe their parents knew nothing. She did it through ridicule. And then she established that she herself was the sex expert that they should come to. And her goal was to reap 5 abortions per girl before they graduated high school. And she only was able to do that by getting them to become sexually active. And the Planned Parenthood curriculum is being used in the schools. And we have presented it to the school board here in Salem. And they told us to quit reading it because it's so filthy. So that is still being used. And the school board hasn't stopped it at all. Now, somebody said that the school boards are going to be in charge of it. But what actually happens is that when you allow money to come to people, it attracts all kinds of people who want to take advantage of that flow of money. And you guys are in charge of starting programs where there's a flow of money. And when there's a flow of money, it's really hard to turn that spigot off because, like this lady, she repented. She became a Christian, and she stopped being a killer of children. And I'm going to submit this to you. These are pictures of a child being killed inside of its mother. And that's not called health care. That's called murder. And this is being done to our children because there are people out there who want to get them sexually active and who gain money from the state of Oregon. The state of Oregon pays for the child killing to go on, and the Planned Parenthood becomes rich because our money is going toward that. Now, Obamacare has released money for the sex change operations that are being encouraged.
Just to put barriers on, we need to make sure that that your comments are germane to the actual bill, and the bill.
Okay,
is,
there's sex change operations that
are
that,
not germane to the bill.
Okay, but these. Okay, this is going to be implemented through these clinics because there are people who want to come to the schools and gain access to children.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee, and my comments of applause to the two ladies here. I agree with them on their statements.
And your name, please?
My name is John Diesel. I'm a retired attorney. I live in Portland, Oregon. I lived in the last 4 years in Washington County. And my group of Parents' Rights in Education has been involved in trying to fight the certification by the school-based health clinic in Tualatin Tigard School District. They wanted to have it authority to distribute condoms and birth control information. Planned Parenthood testified that there that they would certify this SBHC if they did provide condoms and birth control. They refused to. We were involved for a year in fighting a lot of repression that was trying to keep us from testifying. I was even threatened with having the police arrest me and if I continued. And by the way, I want to commend you, Madam Chairman, for your involvement with Oregon City on limiting that to health, because I have no problem with the school-based health clinic as far as providing health, mental health, dental health, and so on. But the thing I have a problem with is their involvement with bringing these kids over to the school-based health clinic and then taking them to that conference, that sex conference in Seaside, which they plan to do in April. And through the amendment process, when you look at Oregon, and we're ranked number one by Planned Parenthood in as far as sex education from kindergarten to the 12th grade, which is an embarrassment. It's also an embarrassment that our former governor was the chairman of the State Department of Education as well as the Health Department, and his minions would be involved in this sex education promotion. So I feel that if you can, in your amendment process, in the legislative procedure and through administrative requirements, that you can limit this to providing health. I was told 10 or 15 years ago when I was attorney down in Medford, and I was approaching the Central Point School District at Crater High School, and they were saying that they weren't going to help take children for advice on abortions or provide contraceptives, and then they completely reversed that, as many others have done. I think that when you look at Oregon and our lack of our educational standards, so we have such a high percentage not graduating from high school, and it's an embarrassment. As a person that's gone through all the public schools in Oregon, I'm a Naval Academy alum, and I have a degree from Oregon State and from Northwestern School of Law. And I think the educational program in Oregon was amazing when we could look to the fact that most of us would graduate from high school. And now look at it. Look at what has happened. I think when young people get involved in thinking about sex all the time, and that it's natural that they decline the cognitive learning. And that's the problem that I have.
Thank you. Now, were one of you three wanted to testify on another bill, too? Or
basically, I wasn't really sure if my testimony might fit some of the others. I'm just kind of against all of them, and that's all I want on the record.
Well,
okay?
Let me just open all of them so that you're
I didn't want to read the same thing over and over and over again. I didn't want to waste your time with that.
I don't have my agenda in front of me. Do you have the agenda? I will open 336, 337, 338, and 339. Might as well have all. Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. And the last one to testify for this bill is Marie. Is it Devin?
Marie Demigod. She's with me, and she declined.
Are you declining?
No.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Oh, and Alexandra Lowell.
Does that mean we're not going to get to talk about each of those bills? Does this mean we're not going to get to talk again for the different things?
It was just me that didn't want to talk for all of them.
Because I want to talk to the other bills.
Okay, well, I've opened all of them now, and why don't we just open all of them, and then that way you don't have to keep coming back up and forth. So do you want to just explain each of the bills then, and that way?
Yes, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 337 appropriates $1.4 million to the Oregon Health Authority for the biennium beginning July 1st, 2015, to establish 11 new school-based health centers. Senate Bill 338 appropriates $900,000 to the Oregon Health Authority to expand on planning and administration necessary to accommodate the development and establishment of new school-based health centers. And Senate Bill 339 creates a school nursing consultant within the Oregon Health Authority and establishes a 20-member task force on school nursing. There's no revenue impact, and the fiscal statements haven't been issued.
Okay. So I will need to bring the proponents of the bill up for the others, but I will go ahead and take your testimony on the other bills that you wanted to talk about,
okay.
too.
One at a time? Can I talk at each bill? Or just, is this 3 minutes for all the bills?
Just say what you have to. Since there aren't a lot of people that are signing up for the bills, I can let you go more than 3 minutes.
Well, this is a little bit of change how I thought I was going to do this, but I'm Rebecca Roth, for the record, Salem, Oregon. And I have with me a page here that shows, this is a lady who worked, she signed up for the Planned Parenthood board and worked for 20 years on the Planned Parenthood board, and I'm going to submit this to you guys.
Okay. And, well, just to clarify,
and she
may I just make a comment? I've been told that there are no school-based health clinics in the Salem area. And there are Planned Parenthood clinics, but that's not what we're talking about today. We're not talking about Planned Parenthood.
The reason I'm bringing up Planned Parenthood is because they are in our schools. And our school boards are not getting rid of them. And their curriculum is being used with our students. And then when the students become sexualized through that, then they're going to come to the school-based clinic for the being getting access to an abortion. That's why I'm bringing up Planned Parenthood. Planned Parenthood was started to affect abortions, and this lady served on an board for Planned Parenthood for 20 years, and she came to the conclusion that Planned Parenthood was focused on eliminating black babies. And there's a lot of evidence that can be accessed, which I can make available to you for that. The number one killer in the black community is abortion. And people keep talking about the poor, and that actually is a code word for black. And so in the black community here in Oregon, there's a Planned Parenthood that located itself right in the black community. And those school-based clinics that are in the schools are going to be accessed by Planned Parenthood, and they're going to be a channel to get those kids over to Planned Parenthood. And this wouldn't be so crazy, except that it's actual historical fact that the Democrat Party started the KKK to lynch black people, and when the Republicans started the Department of Justice to
but
to
that's
make
not
lynching,
germane to the bill.
Okay, this is tied in. Give me a second. When the Republicans started the Department of Justice and made lynching a federal crime, then Margaret Sanger went to the KKK and said, "We need to start a different way of doing this because lynching is going to get white people put in prison." And so Margaret Sanger.
In fairness to those who
Margaret
are here to
Sanger,
testify on these measures, I'm going to have to have you.
You gave me 6 minutes.
But you're not talking about the bill.
I am talking about this.
It's
going to come.
Germane. It's not germane to the bill. I'm sorry. Yes. So
Margaret Sanger started Planned Parenthood,
but we're not
to come into people's lives and get rid of black people, and that is going on.
But that's not germane to the bill.
It's going
to
be tied into the.
And please, you're out
clinics.
Of order.
Point of order, Madam Chair. She has been testifying on the truth.
Please, you're out of order. You're out of order. Will you please remove the
people from the room? It is germane to the bill.
Thank you. Would you please proceed?
Yes, my name is Marie Dierman-Gard, and I'm from near Portland, Tigard, Oregon. And I'm just going to be very brief. I know this sex conference at the beach, which are out, and I know that the school-based clinics, health clinics, send the children to that conference. And I know that the ODE says that Corey, whatever his name is, Silverman, who owns a sex shop, who gave the talk and had all of his materials out and films, we know that they must have known he was there. They're trying to say that, well, they didn't know that everything was there. Well, they certainly didn't know that everything was there. And on the program on Channel 6, I think most of you have seen that one, or you can review it. It shows some of the materials that were there. And why would a man who owns a sex shop be giving a talk, the main talk? As far as I understand, I wasn't there. But the students who came back had a lot of remarks, as you saw on that on the Channel 6 program, that they were definitely not trying to discourage students from doing the things that Corey Silverman, whatever his name is, was telling them about. They said, well, that's why he was there. He's trying to discourage them. No. The students say that he was encouraging them. And if you see what he did.
The school-based, just a comment, school-based health centers.
They do a lot of
work. They didn't have those people in their school-based health clinics. They did not sponsor that particular conference. So, again, we need to start getting back to what the bills are about.
All right, I'll be very – I'm not in favor – I'm in favor of the good things that they do. Like someone mentioned the girl who was suicidal. We have the highest suicide rate in the country's ever had of teenagers. A lot of them right near where we live. And so we need to do something. I have a girl. I take students in my house. She's cutting her wrist. She's listening to this stuff that's going on in the schools. That's just one close to me. But it's not right what's going on as far as suicide rate. And then another thing, I don't know, maybe this is off the point, but the police called us together to talk about the girls who are out on the street. All right. He says that we pick them up, and they're the hardest, not the murder cases. They're the hardest. They spit on us, kick us, call us names. And we said, well, what's your rate of success? And he said, we looked around, and then they finally said, not much, because they're right back on the street. But that might be off your thing. But what I was saying, if the ODE is going to let these kind of men, or whoever is responsible for whoever speaks there, don't tell me they don't know what's on the page. It's not that big of a place. They know what's there. Why are they saying they don't know? So anyway, I just don't want to take your time. But
I appreciate your comments. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
All right. I think we're done with Senate Bill 336. And
you have one more. I'm Alexandra.
Oh, you are?
Yes.
Cool. Reopen.
Madam Chair, I appreciate the testimony today. Also, I wanted to make sure that people knew another chance to make their views known about the Oregon Department of Education is that whenever a state agency has a budget that needs to be passed, there's public testimony on that budget, and that might be another opportunity for people to make their views known.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Alexandra Lowell, and I am the program manager for Multnomah County Health Department school-based health centers. Our program spans four school districts, Portland Public, David Douglas, Park Rose, and Centennial, with 13 school-based health centers. We operate the largest school-based health system in Oregon and serve over 6,600 students each year. Our program helps ensure that children and adolescents are physically and mentally healthy so that they are ready to learn. We are full primary care clinics, meaning we provide medical care, mental health counseling, and family outreach without concern for the student's ability to pay. We work as a team with students, but also with families, teachers, counselors, coaches, and school administration. Because we are located in the schools, we are a critical access point. We help schools succeed by reducing student absences. We help parents and families by providing health care where students are, so parents miss less work. And most of all, we help students by providing care regardless of their ability to pay. Our program has several funding streams as we seek self-sustainability. We successfully bill insurance, both Medicaid and private. We actively seek and are awarded grants, which can be federal, state, and private. And we receive county general funds, which are limited due to the many demands from many important programs that the county funds. Our payer mix for medical services is about 50% Medicaid, 25% private insurance, and 25% county general fund. Once administrative and operational costs are included, our reliance on county general funds increases to about 30%. Our program, composed of 13 clinics across four school districts, serves very large and diverse communities that have high needs. As the population continues to increase, coupled with the eastward shift of poverty, there is an unmet need that we have yet to address. The current lack of parity in funding in the funding formula results in a loss of $84,000 much-needed dollars coming into our program. The result is a disincentive for us to expand services to meet expanding needs in a growing community. Every time we add a school-based health center, the gap is larger and our unfunded needs grow. Multnomah County Health Department strongly supports the establishment of parity funding, which will help us address unmet need in school communities that we are currently serving. It also incentivizes us and others to expand and focus on high-need communities in East Multnomah County. In this way, together, we are maximizing our investment in children and adolescents to learn, graduate, and have healthy and productive lives. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you so much for coming. All right, well, we can close now Senate Bill 336, and then should we go to 337? Or this one's a bit. We'll continue on to Senate Bill 338. Are there comments that need to be made about 338? Okay, we'll close. Then we need, is it Kimberly Scott who wants to speak? Okay.
Sorry, was that 338? 338.
Okay.
My name's Kimberly Scott. I live in Hillsborough. I have three kids in the Washington County School District. My dad was a teacher at Lenox. I'm just kind of a lone parent, but representing a lot of parents. I have been volunteering in the school district. I have a 25-year-old, so I've been in the school every week for the last 20 years. I kind of got started here in the Hillsborough School District being concerned about the sex ed policies that were being presented to my middle school son, and it all kind of steamrolled into me going into the talk to the school board. I know that I'm trying to get to your school-based health center that concerns me. And my reasons for that. They were updating their guidelines for the district, and there were so many unanswered questions as I studied and tried to understand the new guidelines they were voting on. I got no answer. I had many meetings. I did lots of study. I did a lot of follow-up. And one of the things that the school board said to me when they went ahead and passed these guidelines, well, you should go to Salem. I said, if I can't get my school board to explain this to me or them themselves understand this, then who in Salem's going to listen to me? And so what are you going to say? Go to Washington, D.C.? I mean, so here I am. I'm an Oregon native. I love kids. I have six of my own. I nanny four kids. I'm a teacher at church. I teach music. I was in Vernonia. I was involved in the whole new schools there. What worries me about getting a school-based health center is it puts another, I feel like I had so many problems even getting information to myself about my son's seventh grade sex ed curriculum. I had problems understanding. I went in and talked to the ninth grade health teacher. The things they were sending out, recommending to the kids in the classroom, even the posters that were up in the classroom, I was surprised at. I feel like if a school, I just feel like it's another kind of an overreach. I have a 25-year-old. We still pay her health insurance. I work for two physician's assistants and a nurse at Kaiser. Lots of access to health care. I feel like what happens when we open up a new agency, there is less accountability. I don't know what community partnerships will come in. It has so many unknowns. And then I feel like once it's there, you like can't change things as a parent. You can. I brought a lot of parents in. I feel like the kids need us more than ever, and we do need to be partnered as community members and families. And I love that idea, but what worries me when we have more spending and incentives and just digging into the sexuality conference thing, it opened up more lists of agencies that kind of sponsored it, and it seemed to me that it's kind of incentivizing poorer schools or smaller districts to send kids and teachers and counselors to these to this conference, you know, for grants. And I know, like, some of the people, and so I feel like it's true what someone said earlier, when you hand them the money, you give them the incentive to do it. It sounds really great. We all want to help. We all want kids to have people who care and notice. But I just think it opens up so many other issues where you take parents' rights out of it, parents' responsibilities out of it, and ignore the wishes of, I mean, I hear a lot about, you know, disadvantaged or economically, you know, people that don't have access. But I can tell you I'm surrounded by loving families and churches who are in there doing all the coaching, doing all the community clubs, sponsoring all the, you know, the teachers. And then we have so many problems with funding for, I mean, at West Union, they had their sewer backed up and their walls are crumbling and they have a tiny cafeteria. And yet people are on a waiting list to get into that small school. And we need more teachers, more counselors, more money for schools, adding another health based huge you know, center seems like such a low priority. I feel like the money could be better spent. Our schools struggle. Vernonia struggled to get their school up. And so for what it's worth, I would appreciate more attention to this. And it has motivated me with all the things I'm doing now to galvanize parents to get in there and find out more, with as busy as we are supporting everything we do, to pay attention and to hold people accountable. Because I feel like once it starts, there is no accountability. It's lip service. That's what I happened in our school district from the administration and our school board. So here I am at Salem and hoping to learn a lot, and I appreciate your time.
And you were right to go to your school board. That's one thing. When we passed this law, we gave control. We wanted local control. And so it's interesting that your school board said, well, go to Salem, because we gave them the control to determine what services they can have in their school-based health clinics. But thank you so much
thank
for coming.
Thank you so much.
Okay, I can close the public hearing on Senate Bill 338. And we still have Senate Bill 339. Well, wait, how about 337? What are we doing on 337? So we'll close. You didn't have anything to say on 337. You've said all that you wanted to say. We'll close the public hearing on 337. So what we have left is Senate Bill 339. Anyone, proponents? Laura Keller, who's coming first on the proponents on 339? Okay. Margot
and the Lalich and Nina Fakaris.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jennifer Baker, testifying on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association on Senate Bill 339. In 2009, the legislature made a recommendation. Many of you worked on this legislation that would that asked the state to get to a point where there was one school nurse for every 750 students in the state. Currently, we have one school nurse for about every 4,054 students with no plan to meet the legislative goal. So the members of the Oregon Student Nurses Association, or School Nurses Association, sorry, have crafted a policy to help remedy this problem, and ONA is excited to support that policy. The bill does two main things. It creates a school nurse consultant within the Oregon Health Authority, and it creates a task force to look at how to better fund school health services and hopefully move away from using education dollars to do the funding for school health services and towards healthcare dollars. And tomorrow, Senate Bill 698 will be first read. And we're hoping that this will actually be the
What number is it?
698. And we're hoping for this to be the vehicle for this legislation and this concept. It, too, has a school nurse consultant embedded in the Oregon Health Authority to liaison with the current school nurse consultant in the education or the Department of Education. It has a task force that has been cut down, so it is not as large as the task force included in Senate Bill 339. And it also asked the task force to look specifically at a few things. One would be stable funding for screenings for vision, hearing, and possibly dental to figure out a way that we can secure funding for those things. And also to look to see if there's any way that school nurses can be reimbursed by insurance that students hold for services that would otherwise be reimbursable if provided in a different setting. So I will leave it to the school nurses who are here to talk more to the policy, but urge the committee to consider moving this concept in Senate Bill 698.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee. My name is Margot Lalich, and I am the Director of School Health Services for Multnomah Educational Service District. And I feel like I have to add, because of the conversation, that I was formerly the Director of Public Health for Clatsop County, where the Adolescent Sexuality Conference has been held for a long time and is quite controversial this year. School nurses serve children on a continuum, a healthcare continuum, from the medically fragile to the general population. MESD's goal is to ensure the safety of students by providing the highest standard of nursing care in the school and community setting so that every student has the opportunity to achieve their educational potential. We provide school nursing to eight component school districts in Multnomah County, as well as parts of Clackamas County. We have 110 plus nurses, give or take, students that enroll or disenroll. We serve 160 schools that serve 100,000 students ages 3 to 21 years, which is 20% of the state's total enrollment. We're the only ESD with a comprehensive school nursing program and the single largest provider of school nursing services. Historically, school nursing was part of the public health system, and I share this because we're asking for a state nurse school nurse consultant to be housed within the Oregon Health Authority. In some Oregon communities, school nursing remains housed in the local public health authority, and in Multnomah County, it was in public health until the 70s when it transitioned into the educational service district. Oregon is focused on health and education transformation initiatives and the alignment of learning and health systems in the pediatric population. School health services, school-based health centers, school nursing are a portal to the pediatric population. And this bill supports the creation of an infrastructure to track and analyze data to inform best practice. I'd like to speak to the task force first. The statewide task force is critical to ensuring an equitable and effective system for the delivery of school nursing services and school health services throughout the state. Currently, the state is spending between $23 and $25 million per year of education classroom dollars to fund school nursing. However, there's no infrastructure in Oregon to set standards, collect and analyze health data, provide oversight, or to align the delivery of health services provided by school nurses. The infrastructure is critical to the state's ability to evaluate the impact of dollars invested in student health and well-being and to ensure the best allocation of resources. An example from MESD is last school year, we had 56,000 office visits to the school nurse. Data from these 56,000 visits should inform best practices and the allocation of resources. However, without a structure to collect and deliver data at the state level, the data has limited value. 90% of funding for school nursing nationwide comes from education. The care provided is often billable and reimbursed by the health system outside of the school setting. The case for an OHA nurse consultant and a nurse consultant co-housed at ODE. The Oregon Health Authority nurse consultant will be responsible for promoting statewide quality standards for school health policies, nursing scope of practice, and clinical procedures, documentation, and for initiating and coordinating a quality assurance program for accountability. This is the national standard for school nurse consultants across the country. In states that have a school nurse consultant, 14 have the position equally situated in the Department of Health and Department of Education. 7 states have the position in both systems. OHA is the logical agency to staff a nurse consultant because they have an existing infrastructure in the school and adolescent health program, as well as the nurse consultant position supporting the important work of school-based health centers. ODE is the agency that owns the physical infrastructure, employs nurses, controls the school setting, and ensures learning. Evidence supports the critical importance of both school-based health centers and school nursing. The OHA Nurse Consultant Task Force will inform this very important work that will support continued academic success, lifelong achievement, the health of students, their support systems, and community. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's about time we start addressing this issue.
Yeah.
I've always felt that we should not be using education funds for health care.
Thank you, Chair Mona Sanderson. My name's Nina Fakaris. I'm a school nurse in the Beaverton School District. Worked very closely with you folks in 2008 and 2009 with the passage of the previous school nurse legislation. And I'm honored and thank you for considering my testimony today. I bring a national perspective to this particular topic. I have just recently served a 5-year term as Oregon's representative on the board of directors of the National Association of School Nurses, 2 of those years on their executive committee. And I've seen systems and setups throughout the country with my colleagues and nurses across the United States. And the states that have the most robust and successful school health service program, including school nursing, collaborating with healthcare providers such as school-based health centers, are those states that have co-housed state school nurse consultants within their public health division and within their Department of Education. And so I'm strongly urging the passage of this language in our bill. I think it's vital that we be able to begin to coordinate and collaborate health services and healthcare delivery between the Department of Ed and the Oregon Health Authority. As far as looking at now steps for the future, you know, and Jen mentioned the task force language. by 2020, we're supposed to reach the ratio of one school nurse to every 750 students. Education dollars cannot fund that alone, and I agree that we need to start looking at other healthcare funding streams for school nursing services. The last 3 years, I've been working with our local CCO in meeting with them and talking about how they develop their metrics and looking at their rubric systems and looking at all the reimbursable things, and it amazed me the number of collaborative efforts that school nurses can provide physicians in the community, the information and data that they require to help meet some of those reimbursable metrics and the rubrics that have been set up. And to me, it's just kind of one of those no-brainers. We have access to the children 6 to 7 hours a day, 5 days a week, and we can provide healthcare providers that data that they require. Right now, I serve 3,688 students. 413 of my students have asthma. Asthma is one of the leading causes of student absenteeism, which correlates to no graduation. The more days children are absent, the more likely is they won't graduate. One person, I don't have time to talk to all 413 kids about asthma and their triggers and how to manage it and how to handle it. I have 106 students that have life-threatening anaphylactic reactions. So I do trainings to save their lives every day. I have 41 students that have seizure disorders. And the reason this is important is because recently, within the last several years, new medication to treat seizure disorders have come on, and it's a rectally administered medication, which has huge implications when we're trying to train staff how to administer a medication like that in the school setting. I was pleased to be able to be here on the day that the Diabetes Association was here with you. I have 22 type 1 diabetics in my schools. I meet with every single one of them, and I meet with every single one of their parents, and we develop individualized plans on how to take care of those children at school. That's my job, is to keep those kids safe. This year so far, I've written 220 individual health management and emergency care plans for children in my school. Schools have changed. Healthcare has changed. We bring all those health disparities into the school building, and I believe this legislation will help support school nurses in providing the care our kids deserve. Thank you.
I have a question. Do you have a school-based health center in your school also?
I do not have a school-based health center in my school. There's a brand new one in our district at one of the other comprehensive high schools that we're thrilled about. We were able to the way we set it up, we were able to refer kids from all of our buildings into that school-based health center. And so, yes, we're very excited to be able to utilize them. You know, I also realize there's, you know, what, 60-some schools in Beaverton. You know, we're not going to be able to put 60 school-based health centers there. But I do believe the school nurse can be the conduit to the school-based health center, as we do with other primary care providers in our neighborhoods.
Well, when I was at Oregon City High School, the school nurse was going to take a week off, and so I had to cover all of her patients. And let me tell you, there's a big difference between a school nurse and a school-based health clinic nurse, because I had to do tube feedings. I had to do a number of skills that I had to be trained on. So there's definitely a difference in the skill level of in the services that are provided. And the fact that that type of money is being taken out of the education funding, we really need to look at a different form of funding. Yeah.
Madam Chair, a couple of weeks ago, I asked, and you asked as well, about OHA getting back to us on how CCOs were dealing with nurse practitioner parity. We haven't heard anything back from OHA.
Not yet.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, following up on that, if I could. So one of the things I noticed in the testimony from Multnomah County was that 25% of the funding comes from private payers. And I'd be interested to know if how those private payers were reimbursing and if they've assured the school-based health clinics that they're paying on parity, because that could be a significant bump to just ensuring that they're following the law.
When do we have that
we actually have that parity bill in 2 weeks. I forget when, but it is on the schedule, so that would be the appropriate time to sort of focus in on payment parity. Kay. Yeah. Thank you very much. Okay, Laura and Steve, is it Moody?
More,
sorry. Your D looked like an, or R looked like a D. And Nikki Zimmerman?
Are we to be joined by another? I thought. No? Okay, I'll start then. Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, thank you for having me here this afternoon. My name is Steve Moore, and I'm the president-elect of the Oregon School Nurse Association. I support Senate Bill 339, which seeks to establish the legislative task force that we've discussed, as well as the state school nurse consultant housed at the Oregon Health Authority. I'm a registered nurse with a master's degree from the St. Louis University School of Public Health. I come to school nursing from about 20 years of being a public health nurse, and I've been a school nurse for just a short period of time. I decided to make that career move because I see Oregon as a leader in the nation in health care reform and health reform, more importantly than health care. And my public health background tells me that this is the right place to be at the right time to help students reach not only their full health potential, but also their education achievements that they can achieve if they're healthy to do so. I supervise nurses in the East Multnomah County. I also supervise nurses who staff the outdoor school program in for Multnomah County. And those nurses that I supervise vary from one-to-one nurses who take care of one student with very complex chronic health needs to population delivery nurses who conduct wellness activities, screening activities, and the kind of things that keep kids out of doctor's offices and hospitals, which is a part of the triple aim that Oregon is trying to achieve through its healthcare reform. I'm also honored to be here on the day that the American Diabetes Association was here. I'm part of the Safe at School program that Mr. Bruhn talked about. And I just want to talk a little bit about what that looks like for a student with diabetes when you have one nurse who covers an entire district. Typically, a student with diabetes, let's say a second grader who's newly diagnosed, the parents are trying to figure out this bombshell that got dropped on them. How are we going to make this work? They go to their school, making sure that their student can continue to get the kind of care that the doctor and the diabetes educators told them that they needed. Our nurses, say if we're in one nurse for one district, they may be in that school once every 6 days. And so it's important that there's a lot of coordination that needs to happen between the family, the doctor's office, the school, and the nurse to make sure that student can safely go to school. And so for this one student, when we have one nurse in that school once every 6 days, that means that that nurse is going to be delegating care for that student. So through the delegation process, that a nurse, a task that only a nurse can do legally under the licensure in Oregon, is going to be basically delegated to a non-licensed care provider who may or may not have any training in health or management of diabetes of any kind. And these are complex procedures. I know when I worked in a hospital, if I was drawing up insulin for a diabetic, I, as a registered nurse with a bachelor's degree, would need to have that cross-checked with another registered nurse to make sure that I was administering a dose of medication that wasn't going to have harmful effects for that student. And so now we're being asked to delegate to our staff in school these complex procedures with potentially extreme complications if something was to go wrong while they manage all of their other tasks that they're trying to take care of in the office. And so I just I'm excited to be here. I think that we have the opportunity to do some great things here in the state, and I'm hopeful through the engagement of this task force, as well as a person in leadership position at the Oregon Health Authority, that we can do better by our students and help them again achieve their optimal health and education outcomes. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Madam Chair and members of the Health Committee, I'm Nikki Zimmerman, and I'm the president of the Oregon School Nurses Association. And I don't know if anyone's clarified that, but that's OSNA. OSNA is a nonprofit organization that delivers educational support for school nurses, and it is affiliated with the National Association of School Nurses, just so you know. And as OSNA president, I can speak to you about why this bill is important to school nurses in Oregon. We hold a lot of truths to be self-evident. We think we keep students healthier. We better academic performance, and that, in fact, we benefit the students of Oregon. We anecdotally can give lots of evidence to support that. And empirically, however, we have lots of statistics and information missing for a number of reasons. First, like we mentioned, our school nurse ratio, we have a lack of school nurses. We are truly too busy out doing our job to even start proving our worth in what we do. Secondly, school nursing is so diverse across the state. Some work with their ESDs, as you've been hearing, others through the health department, some with the individual school districts. It's so varied that it's even hard to determine the exact number of school nurses we do have because it's so varied. And we have no structure to collect and look at any of the data and the impact that we know that we make. And there's also kind of an unspoken issue that the education world doesn't really know or understand a lot of the medical care and issues that we deal with. And the medical world is not really knowledgeable or understanding about the education house that we work in. So we're kind of the bridge between them. This bill would address all of this. It would create a forum and structure to collect hard data, creating a bridge between the world of health and education, and hopefully find ways to bring in more school nurses. For me personally, this is important because, yes, this article Sunday in the Oregonian by Steve Dunn talked about one of my schools, Roosevelt High School, and brought up the fact that Roosevelt has a 53% four-year graduation rate and how we are trying to improve things. What the article didn't say is that the graduation rate was about 40% 4 years ago. I am proud to say that I am part of Roosevelt on the Rise, and I am proud to know that I am part of that graduation rate increase from my work at that school, the most culturally diverse, poorest socioeconomic, highest teen pregnancy rate high school in the state of Oregon. Mm-hmm. So I know that if I, as one nurse, can help make positive changes at such a school, that having more school nurses will improve things across the state. It does take a village to bring students to their potential, and school nursing is part of that village. We see the whole student, not just the academics that the teachers look at, and not just the health that the providers look at. And just last Friday, I was helping a student who jammed his finger playing basketball in the gym, and he was looking at the pictures of my boys on my bulletin board. And he said, "They're mama's boys, aren't they?" And I asked him, "Well, what do you mean about that?" With that, and he looked at the pictures. He says, "You have one from every year of their life. They're different. You can tell they've never wanted for nothing and have everything. My mom hasn't seen me for days, hasn't gotten me anything for my birthday or Christmas for years, and doesn't even have a picture of me anywhere. It brought me to tears. It is not always easy to educate children in the best of circumstances, but almost impossible in the worst. While a medical provider will diagnose, treat, and give students whatever they need, they are not with them daily to manage whatever their particular medical condition is. School nurses are, and that is where we should be. It's our calling. Should I be following up more with the over 30 concussions that can and do happen each school year? Should I be following up more with my 100 students with asthma? Should I be doing more with our students with medical and health issues? Absolutely. This bill would help us start to get organized and do things in a more effective way. And for the students of Oregon, and on behalf of the school nurses of Oregon, and for the teachers and families of Oregon, I thank you for your support of this bill and be happy to answer any questions. And by the way, I do have a picture of that student next to my boys in my office now and told him he'd always have a place on my bulletin board and in my heart.
So. Oh. I now know why school nurses need to be in every school with nurses like you. It brings tears to my eyes to know the care and the love that you're giving so many kids that don't get that love at home. Yeah. All right, questions? All right, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
And Lori Porter, Tricia Smith, and Doug Riggs. Oh, you give it to Cameron. Yeah, and he'll hand it out. We'll have Lori go first.
I've submitted some I'm Lori Porter and I'm the Director of Parents' Rights in Education. But prior to my testimony, I just wanted to say that I have submitted testimony from a school board member who was not able to be here, and she and her district, they are reviewing whether to have a school-based health center there or not. I also have submitted testimony from a gal from Clatsop County who there was the attempt to have a school-based health center in that area, that county, and that was voted down. And she shares her story and some of her concerns in that testimony. As I said, I am the Director of Parents' Rights in Education, and we are a grassroots organization intent on protecting and advocating for parents' rights to guide the education of their children. I've taught public school for 23-plus years, and I'm here today on behalf of many concerned Oregonians from around the state. It would be fiscally irresponsible to fund any new school-based health centers. School-based health centers threaten the legal rights, moral responsibilities, and privileges of parents and guardians, and I will explain, give you some information about that here. Parents and guardians have the ultimate legal authority over not only the education, but the health care of their children. Sending children to public schools does not automatically relinquish parental rights. School-based health care makes government the interloper between parent and child, and too often is promoting and providing confidential health services without parents knowing or without their consent. Attached to my testimony is evidence of the Oregon Department of Education and Oregon Health Authority encouraging health-related services to minors without parental permission. Where are Oregonians getting a return on their investment when it comes to school-based health centers? Since the rise in number of school-based health centers in Oregon, there has not been any evidence of improved academic performance among youth. It's a well-known fact that Oregonians' graduation rates and academic achievements have declined. Where is the evidence that school-based health centers improve student academic performance? The Senate bills are requesting what looks to be over $2 million of state taxpayer dollars for new school-based health centers. Additionally, there is the expense incurred from the statewide unscientific and privacy-invasive Healthy Teens Survey, which is used to, quote, justify the need of new school-based health centers, and there's information in your packet about that. School-based health centers across the state send youth to the recently exposed controversial adolescent sexuality conference held in Seaside each April. For example, unbeknownst to the St. Helens School District board members, their school-based health centers Center sent 9 students to the 2014 ASC conference, which put the mental and physical health of minors at risk by distributing materials and having workshops which promoted porn, sexting, BDSM, and other risky sexual behaviors. Attached is information that you have about a St. Helens High School health fair put on by a school-based health center youth team. This fair featured an organization, Transactive, which promotes puberty inhibitors to minors and shares how to dodge parental notification. Transactive, an organization where the executive director was a keynote speaker at the 2013 AS Adolescent Sexuality Conference, and there's information in your packet about that. In Section 1-8 of Senate Bill 339, it speaks of coordinating school nursing activities with public health, social services, environmental and educational agencies, as well as other public and private entities. What specific, quote, entities will be involved with advertising to or promoting performing health care services to our children? School administrators, teachers, and school boards have enough to do with regards to providing a quality education to Oregon students. How will they be expected to find the time to monitor, evaluate, and inform parents about any and all private and public entities coming onto their school properties? Section 1-3 of Senate Bill 339 states that the Oregon Health Authority will be supporting and leading the integration of coordinated school health teams. Who is going to be included in this coordinated school health team? Where is the assurance that the rights of parents won't be usurped? Parents are the ultimate legal authority over the health care and education of their children. Government agencies and private agencies have no business trespassing on the hearts, minds, bodies, and souls of our children. The family is the premier social service agency. It would be fiscally irresponsible to fund any new school-based health centers. School-based health centers threaten the rights, moral responsibilities, and privileges of Oregon parents and guardians. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And thank you for bringing to our attention the two sections that concern you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Tricia.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, testifying on Senate Bill 339. OSEA members are classified school employees in schools, and absent school nurses or school-based health centers, they are the professionals who are providing health care services to students in schools. They are not trained or educated to be health care professionals. They are educational assistants that were hired to teach kids. Unfortunately, many of the kids have health issues, and those health issues have to be dealt with in schools. And absent health care professionals in schools, it is my members who are required to provide those health care services. And some of those services, frankly, Madam Chair, scare the dickens out of my members. It scares them to intubate breathing tubes on a fragile student. It scares them to have to provide the kinds of services that they have to provide to these very ill students, that they have to provide every day in order to keep their job. They want healthcare professionals in their schools to provide those services to these students. Students need the services in school, and they'd like to have healthcare professionals providing them. We looked at Senate Bill 339 as an opportunity to begin the discussion of how to solve the problem of not having healthcare professionals in schools. We know that the problem exists today because school boards have to choose between hiring teachers and hiring nurses. And in today's education environment, with our class sizes ballooning well out of control, our staff down by thousands as a result of the last recession, the idea that even if they need nurses and they know they need nurses, they also need teachers, and they will choose the teachers more often than not first. That leaves my members providing the health care services yet another year for those students who need health care professionals. Unfortunately, we don't see the bill as it's written as zeroing in on the problem that we see that exists. We don't think school boards necessarily don't want nurses in schools. They do want nurses in schools. They know my members shouldn't be providing these services, but they don't have choices. The problem isn't a matter of desire, it's a matter of funding. And what we hoped from this bill to see very clearly was that this task force, which we think needs to be broadened to include our members, since they are providing the services today, would zero in on the problem of billing. That's the problem that we see in providing school nurses in schools. They can't bill private health insurance for the nursing services that they provide to kids. they have difficulties in districts, particularly small districts, to build those other entities like Medicaid where they could perhaps build them. They may not have the staff to figure out how to do it. Those are the issues that we see that are causing the problems of the lack of healthcare professionals in our schools. And that's what we think this task force should spend its time working on. We appreciate that in my fantasy world of a staffed up full service school with a full school year and all the professionals that kids need, we'll have students, we'll have school nurses in the schools, in every school. And at that point, I bet we do need a coordinator in OHA to help the Department of Education figure out how those services should be provided more globally. I think we've gotten a little ahead of ourselves by going there first instead of trying to figure out the funding problem that keeps staff out of schools and keeps my members terrified they're going to hurt students. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, through record, Doug Riggs on behalf of the Oregon School-Based Health Alliance. I just want to throw my 2 cents in worth. We're fully supportive of Senate Bill 339. If it's moved to be an amendment, it's Senate Bill 698. That would be fine, too. We believe that overall school health is what we're looking for, and there can't be a school-based health center in every school, and we need adequate nursing services. So just here in support of the bill. I think what Tricia mentioned is a very good point. Funding is a critical issue. There's a lack of funding for school health, and we would be supportive of participating in a task force and coming back with some significant recommendations next session.
I'd like to know who would be the point person for Senate Bill 339. I know that Jen would be the point person for 698, but because I'd like, okay, I need to know who for 339, both point person for both bills. Okay, all right. Because what I think the committee wants to know is what are the differences between 339 and 698, and then looking at the suggestions that have been made today to see what we can do with the bill, because I don't think it can pass like it is maybe right now. Okay. Comments?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I don't think any of them are quite the way we want them at this point in time, but we do have some work to do. One of the driving forces behind this is that health care should not be paid for with formula dollars. That's one of the driving forces, especially when most of it is matchable. Mm-hmm. So.
All right, so Jen, did you get those comments? All right. All right, thank you very much. I appreciate it, all of you, pro and con, and I'm glad that we were able to hear everybody. Any other comments with that? Other comments with that? Buddy. Any